What do you mean?
You could live here, she said, then added a beat too quickly. In Chicago, you could, you know, move back to town. I frowned, still playing with my cat. I don't... Look, when the next freak burns down my place, maybe I won't get as lucky as I did last time. Last time you wound up with a broken back and working for a monster, Karen said. Exactly, I said. And it was only because of literal divine intervention that none of my neighbors died, I shook my head. The island isn't a kind place, but no one is going to come looking for trouble there. Except you, she said gently. I worry about what will happen to you if you stay out there alone too long. That kind of isolation isn't good for you, Harry. It's necessary, I said. It's safer for me. It's safer for everyone around me. What a load of crap, she said without heat. You're just scared. You're damn right, I said. Scared that some bug-eyed freak is going to come calling and kill innocent people because they happen to be in my havoc radius. No, she said. That isn't what scares you. She waved a hand. You don't want it to happen, and you'll fight it if it does, but that isn't what scares you. I frowned down at Mister. I'm really not comfortable talking about this. Get over it, Karen said, even more gently. Harry, when the vampires grabbed Maggie, they kind of dismantled your life. They took away all the familiar things, your office, your home, even that ridiculous old clown car. The Blue Beetle was not a clown car, I said severely. It was a machine of justice. I wasn't looking at her, but I heard the smile in her voice, along with something that might have been compassion. You're a creature of habit, Harry, and they took away all the familiar places and things in your life. They hurt you. Something dark and furious stirred way down inside me for a moment, threatening to come out. I swallowed it back down. So, the idea of a fortress, some place familiar that can't be taken away from you, really appeals to you right now, Karen said, even if it means you cut yourself off from everyone. It isn't like that, I said. It wasn't. Was it? And I'm fine, I added. You aren't fine, Karen said evenly. You are a long, long way from fine, and you've got to know that. Mister's fur was soft and very warm beneath my fingers. His paws batted gently at my hands. His teeth were sharp but gentle on my wrist. I'd forgotten how nice it was, the furry beast's simple weight and presence against me. How could I have forgotten that? I'm only human. For now. I shook my head slowly. This is not a good time to get in touch with my feelings. I know it isn't, she said, but it's the first time in months that I've seen you. What if I don't get another chance? She put the cup of tea down on a coaster on the coffee table and said, agreed, there's business to do. But you've got to understand that your friends are worried about you, and that is important too. My friends, I said, so this is a community project? Karen stared at me for a moment. Then she stood up and moved to stand beside the chair. She considered me for a few breaths, then pushed my hair back from my eyes with one hand and said, it's me, Harry. I felt my eyes close. I leaned into her touch. Her hand felt feverishly warm, a wild contrast to the brush of Mab's cold digits earlier in the day. We stayed like that for a moment, and Mister's throaty purr buzzed through the room. There's a power in the touch of another person's hands. We acknowledge it in little ways all the time. There's a reason human beings shake hands, hold hands, slap hands, bump hands. It comes from our very earliest memories, when we all come into the world blinded by light and color, deafened by riotous sound, flailing in a suddenly cavernous space without any way of orienting ourselves, shuddering with cold, emptied with hunger, and justifiably frightened and confused. And what changes that first horror, that original state of terror? The touch of another person's hands. Hands that wrap us in warmth, that hold us close. Hands that guide us to shelter, to comfort, to food. Hands that hold and touch and reassure us through our very first crisis and guide us into our very first shelter from pain. The first thing we ever learn is that the touch of someone else's hand can ease pain and make things better. And that's power. That's power so fundamental that most people never even realize it exists. I leaned my head against Karen's hand and shivered again. Okay, I said quietly. Okay, this is important too. Good, she said. She left her fingers in my hair for another moment and then withdrew her hand. She picked up my teacup and hers and carried them back to the kitchen. So, where did you go after you left the Hard Rock? Hmm? I asked. Her voice drifted in from the kitchen. Given what you told me, you left the meeting with Nicodemus about 3 hours ago. Where have you been since then? I said, yeah, about that. She came back into the room and arched a golden eyebrow at me. What if I told you that I needed you to trust me? She frowned and tilted her head for a moment before the hint of a smile touched her mouth. You went digging for information, didn't you? I said, let's just say that until I know more about what I'm up against, I'm playing things a lot closer to the chest than usual. She frowned. Tell me you aren't doing it for my own protection. You'd kick my ass, I said. I'm doing it for mine. Thank you, she said. I think. Don't thank me, I said. I'm still keeping you in the dark, but I believe it's absolutely necessary. So you need me to trust you? Yeah. She spread her hands. Yeah, okay. So what's the play? I assume you want me to assemble the support team and await developments while you and Thomas go play with the bad guys? I shook my head. Hell no, I want you to go in with me. That shocked her silent for a moment. Her eyes widened slightly. With you, to rob a Greek god. Burgle, technically, I said. I'm pretty sure if you pull a gun on Hades, you deserve whatever happens to you. Why me? She asked. Thomas is the one with the knives and the super strength. I don't need knives and super strength, I said. What's the first rule to protecting yourself on the street? Awareness, she replied instantly. It doesn't matter how badass you are. If you don't see it coming, you can't do anything about it. Exactly, I said. I need you because you don't have supernatural abilities. You never have. You've never relied on them. I need extra eyes. I need to see things happening, someone to watch my back, to notice details. You're the detective who could see that the supernatural was real when everyone else was explaining it away. You've squared off against the worst, and you're still here to talk about it. You've got the best eyes of anyone I know. Karen took that in for a moment and then nodded slowly. And you think I'm crazy enough to actually do it? I need you, I said simply. She considered that gravely. I'll get my gun, she said. Chapter 6. Karen drove us to the address on the card in her new car, one of those little Japanese SUVs that Consumer Reports likes, and we got there about 10 minutes before sundown. An abandoned slaughterhouse, she said. Classy. I thought the stockyard district had all been knocked down and rebuilt, I said. She put the car in park and checked the SIG she carried in a shoulder holster. Almost all of it. A couple of the old wrecks hung on. The wreck in question was a long, low building, a simple old box frame, only a couple of stories high, and running the length of the block. It was sagging and dirty and covered in stains and graffiti, an eyesore that had to have been around since before the Second World War. A painted sign on the side of the building was barely legible, Sullivan Meat Company. The buildings around it were updated brownstone business district standard, but I noticed that no one who worked in them, apparently, had elected to park his car on the slaughterhouse's side of the block. I didn't have to get out of the car to feel the energy around the place. dark, negative stuff, the kind of lingering aura that made people and animals avoid a place without giving much consideration as to why. City traffic seemed to ooze around it in a mindless Brownian fashion, leaving the block all but deserted. Every city has places like that, where people tend not to go. It's not like people run screaming or anything. They just never seem to find a reason to turn down certain streets, to stop on certain stretches of road. And there's a reason that they don't. Bad things happen in places like this. "Go in?" I asked Karen.
"Let's watch for a bit," she said. "See what happens."
"Aye, aye, aye, guy," I said.
"I want you to imagine me kicking your ankle right now," Karen said, "because it's beneath my dignity to actually do it."
"Since when?"
"Since I don't want to get your yucky boy germs on my shoes," she said, watching the street. "So, what's Nicodemus after?"
"No clue," I said. "And whatever he says he's after, I think it's a safe bet that he'll be lying."
"Ask the question from the other direction, then," she said. "What's Hades got?"
"That's the thing," I said. "My sources say he's the collector of the supernatural world. He's famous for it. Art, treasure, gems, jewels, antiques, you name it."
"Nicodemus doesn't seem like an antiquer to me," I snorted.
"Depends. There are a lot of kinds of antiques. Old coins, old swords."
"For example," she said, "you think he's after some kind of magical artifact?"
"Yeah, something specific. It's the only thing I can think of that he couldn't get somewhere else," I said.
"Could he be trying to make something happen with the act of burglary itself?"
I shrugged. "Like what? Other than pissing off something as big, powerful, and pathologically vengeful as a freaking Greek god? Those guys took things personally."
"Right. What if he's setting it up to make it look like someone else did the crime?" I grunted.
"Worth considering. But it seems like there'd be a simpler way to accomplish the same thing than to break into someone's version of hell."
I frowned. "Ask you something?"
"Sure. You planning to bring one of the swords with you?"
Karen had two swords that had been forged with nails from the cross.
Yeah, that cross, worked into the blades.
They were powerful talismans, born by the Knights of the Cross, the natural foes of Nicodemus and his crew of 30 silver-coined lunatics.
Yeah, those 30 pieces of silver.
She frowned, her eyes scanning the street, and didn't answer for a moment. When she did, I had the impression that she was choosing her words carefully.
"You know, I have to be careful with them."
"They're weapons, Karen," I said. "They're not glass figurines. What's the point in having two genuine, holy swords with which to fight evil if you don't, you know, fight evil with them occasionally?"
"Swords are funny," she replied. "The most capable, muscle-powered tool there is for killing a man. But they're fragile, too. Use them the wrong way, and they'll break like glass."
"The Denarians are on the field," I said. "They're the people the swords were meant to challenge. The things inside the coins are what the swords were meant to fight. The ones holding the coins are the people the swords were meant to save," she said, her tone gently emphatic. "And that's why I'm not carrying one. I don't want to save those animals, Harry. And it's not enough to use the swords against the right foe. You have to use them for the right reasons, or they could be lost forever. I won't be the reason that happens."
"So you will just let them sit and do nothing?" I asked.
"I'll give them to anyone I think will use them wisely and well," she said calmly. "But people like that don't come along every day. Being a keeper of the swords is a serious job, Harry. You know that." I sighed.
"Yeah, I do. But Nicodemus and his girl are right over there in that building, and we could use every advantage we can get."
Karen suddenly smiled. It transformed her face, though her eyes never stopped sweeping the street.
"You're just gonna have to have a little faith, Harry."
"Faith? That if a knight with a sword needs to be here, one will be here. For all we know, Sonya will come walking down the street and get in the car with us."
I scowled at that. even though she was probably right. When a knight of the sword was meant to show up and intervene, one would damn well make an entrance and intervene, regardless of who or what stood in the way. I'd seen it more than once. But part of me hated to let go of the advantage the swords would offer. Of course, that was what faith was all about, wasn't it? Letting go and trusting someone else. Maybe wizards just weren't terribly predisposed to surrendering control. I mean, not when they have so much personal power available to them. Once you've had your hands on the primal forces that created the universe, it's a little hard to relax and let them slip through your fingers. It would certainly explain why so few of the wizards I knew were even mildly religious. Also, it illustrated pretty clearly why I was never, ever going to be a knight. Aside from the fact that I was working for the Queen of the Wicked Fairies and getting into bed with jerks like Nicodemus, I mean. Karen's eyes flicked up to her rearview mirror and sharpened.
"Car," she said quietly.
In a spy movie, I would have watched them coolly in the rearview mirror, or perhaps in my specially mirrored sunglasses. But as I'm neither cool nor a spy, nor did I feel any particular need for stealth, I twisted my upper body around and peered out the back window of Karen's car. A white sedan with a rental agency's bumper sticker on it pulled up to the curb halfway down the block. It was shuddering as it did, as if it could barely get its engine to turn over, even though it was a brand new vehicle. Before it had entirely stopped moving, the passenger door swung open, and a woman stepped out onto the street, as though she just couldn't stand to be stuck in one place. She was striking, rangy, and nearly 6 feet tall, with long and intensely curled dark hair that fell almost to her waist. She wore sunglasses, jeans, and a thick, tight scarlet sweater that she filled out more noticeably than most. Her cowboy boots struck the street decisively in long strides as she crossed it, heading toward the old slaughterhouse. Her sharp chin was thrust forward, her mouth set in a firm line, and she walked as though she felt certain that the way was clear, or had better be.
"Hot," Karen said, her tone neutral, observational. "Human?"
I wasn't getting any kind of supernatural vibe off of her, but there's more than one way to identify a threat.
"Can't be sure," I said, "but I think I know who she is."
"Who?"
"A warlock," I said.
"That's a rogue wizard, right?"
"Yeah. When I was in the wardens, they used to send out wanted posters for warlocks so the wardens could recognize them. I didn't hunt warlocks, but I was on the mailing list."
"Why didn't you?" she asked. "Word is that they're dangerous."
"Dangerous children, most of them," I said. "Kids who no one ever taught or trained or told about the laws of magic." I nodded toward the woman.
"That one's name is Hannah Asher. She was on the run longer than any other warlock on recent record. She's supposed to have died in a fire in Australia, I think, about 6 years ago."
"You drowned once. How much pressure did the council put on you after that?"
"Good point," I said.
"What did she do?" Karen asked.
"Originally, Asher burned 3 men to death from the inside out," I said.
"Jesus.
Killed 1 warden back before my time. She's put 3 more in the hospital over the years."
"Wizards trained to hunt rogue wizards, and she took them out?"
"Pretty much. Probably why she doesn't look worried about walking in there right now."
"Neither will we when we go in," Karen said.
"No, we won't," I said.
"Here comes the driver."
The driver's side door opened, and a bald, blocky man of medium height in an expensive black suit got out. Even before he reached up to take off his sunglasses to reveal eyes like little green agates, I recognized him. Karen did, too, and let out a little growling sound. He put the sunglasses away in a pocket, checked what was probably a gun in a shoulder holster, and hurried to catch up to Asher, an annoyed expression on his blunt-featured face.
"Binder," she said.
"Ernest Armand Tinwhistle," I said. "Name that goofy. Don't blame him for wanting to use an alias. Though, honestly, he hadn't chosen it. The wardens had given it to him when they'd realized how he'd somehow managed to bind an entire clan of entities out of the Never-Never into his service. He could whistle up a modest horde of humanoid creatures who apparently felt nothing remotely like pain or fear, and who were willing to sacrifice themselves without hesitation. Binder was a one-man army, and I'd told the little jerk that if I saw him in my town again, I'd end him. I'd told him to stay out, and yet here he was. For about 3 seconds, I couldn't think about anything but ending him. I'd have to make it fast, take him out before he could call up any of his buddies, something quick, like breaking his neck. Open the car door, call up a flash of light as I got out, something to dazzle his newly unshaded eyes. 12 sprinting steps to get to him, then grab him by the jaw and the back of the head and twist sharply up and to one side, then bring up a shield around myself in case his brain stayed alive long enough to drop a death curse on me. "Harry," Karen said, quiet and sharp. I realized that I was breathing hard and that my breath was pluming into frost on the exhale as the mantle of power of the winter night had begun informing my instincts in accord with the primal desire to defend my territory against an intruder. The temperature in the car had dropped as if she'd turned the AC up full blast. Water was condensing into droplets on the windows. I closed my eyes as the winter rose up in me and fought it down. I'd done it often enough over the past year on the island that it was almost routine. You can't stave off the howling, primitive need for violence that came with the winter mantle with the usual deep breathing techniques. There was only one way that I'd found that worked. I had to assert my more rational mind. So I ran through my basic multiplication tables in my head, 6 mathematical theorems, which took several seconds, then hammered out ruthless logic against the need to murder Binder in the street. 1, witnesses, I muttered. Even deserted, this is still Chicago, and there could be witnesses, and that would get their attention. 2, Asher's out there, and if she takes his side, she could hit me from behind before I could defend myself. 3, if he's savvy enough to avoid the grab, I'd be out there with 2 of them on either side of me. The winter mantle snarled and spat its disappointment somewhere in my chest, but it receded and flowed back out of my thoughts, leaving me feeling suddenly more tired and fragile than before. But my breathing and body temperature returned to normal. I watched as Binder broke into a slow jog until he caught up with Asher. The 2 spoke quietly to each other as they entered the old slaughterhouse. 4, I said quietly, killing people is wrong. I became conscious of Karen's eyes on me. I glanced at her face. Her expression was tough to read. She put her hand on mine and said, "Harry, are you all right?" I didn't move or respond. "Mab," Karen said. "This is about Mab, isn't it? This is what she's done to you." "It's winter," I said. "It's power, but it's all primitive, violent. It doesn't think. It's pure instinct, feeling, emotion. And when it's inside you, if you let your emotions control you, it makes you like Lloyd Slate," Karen said, "or that bitch Maeve." I pulled my hand away from hers and said, "Like I said, this is not the time to get in touch with my feelings." She regarded me for several seconds before saying, "Well, that is all kinds of fucked up." I huffed out 6 in a little laugh, which threatened to bring some tears to my eyes, which made the recently roused winter start stirring down inside me again. I chanced a quick look at Karen's eyes and said, "I don't want to be like this." "So get out of it," she said. "The only way out is feet first," I said. She shook her head. "I don't believe that," she said. "There's always a way out, a way to make things better." Oh, man. I wanted to believe that. Outside, the sun set. Sunset isn't just a star orbiting below the relative horizon of the planet. It's a shift in supernatural energy. Don't believe me? Go out far away from the lights of civilization sometime, and sit down all by yourself where there aren't any buildings or cars or telephones or crowds of people. Go sit down, quietly, and wait for the light to fade. Feel the shadows lengthening. Feel the creatures that stay quiet during the day start to stir and come out. Feel that low instinct of nervous trepidation rising up in your gut. That's how your body translates that energy to your senses. To a wizard like me, sundown is like a single beat on some unimaginably enormous drum. Dark things come out at night. And I didn't have time right now to dither about where I had my feet planted. I had 3 days to screw over Nicodemus Arcleone and his crew and get this thing out of my head without getting myself or my friend killed while I did it. I had to stay focused on that. There'd be time to worry about other things after. It's time, I said to Karen and opened the car door. Come on. We've got work to do. Chapter 7. We got out of Karen's little SUV and headed toward the creepy old slaughterhouse full of dangerous beings, which pretty much tells you what kind of day I was having right there. You know, sometimes it feels like you don't have any other kind of day. Like, ever. On the other hand, I'm not sure what I would really do with any other kind of day. I mean, at some point in my life, I had to face it. I was pretty much equipped by experience and inclination for mayhem. Too bad, Karen mused. Too bad what? We didn't have time to get you an actual haircut, she said. Seriously, did you do it yourself, maybe without a mirror? I put a hand up to my head, self-consciously, and said, I had some help from the general. And hey, I didn't say anything about your man's shoes. They're steel-toed, she said calmly, in case I need to plant them in anyone's ass as a result of him calling them man-shoes. And seriously, you let Toot help you with your hair? Sure as hell wasn't going to let Alfred try it. He'd probably scrape it off with a glacier or something. Alfred? Demon reach. Karen shuddered. That thing. It's not so bad, I said. Not exactly charming company, but not bad. It's a demon that drove an entire town full of people insane to keep them away. And it could have done much, much worse, I said. It's a big, ugly dog. A cop should know about those. You're glad it's there when someone breaks into your house, she said, because then it can drive them so freaking crazy that the city erases all record of the incident. Exactly. And then no one remembers your ugly man shoes. By then we'd reached the door. Both of us knew why we were giving each other a hard time. There was nothing mean-spirited in it. We were both scared. I would go through the door first. My spell-wrought black leather duster was better armor than the vest Karen would be wearing beneath her coat. I gripped my new staff and readied my mind to throw up a shield if I needed one. We'd done this dance before. If something was ready to come at us, I'd hold it off, and she would start putting bullets in it. Karen folded her arms over her chest, which happened to put her hand near the butt of her gun, and nodded at me. I nodded back, made sure my duster was closed across my front, and opened the door. Nothing came screaming out of the shadows at us. Nobody started shooting at us. So far, so good. The door opened onto a long hallway with light at the far end, enough to let us walk by. The interior walls of the building were old and cracked and covered in decades of graffiti. The night had brought a cold wind off the lake, and the building creaked and groaned. The air smelled like mildew and something else, something almost beneath the threshold of perception that set my teeth on edge. Old, old death. These evil freaks, Karen said. They always pick the most charming places to hang out. Dark energy here, I said. Keeps people from wandering in and randomly interfering. And it feels homey. I know you haven't burned down any buildings in a while, she said, But if you start feeling the need...
When we reached the end of the hallway, it turned into a flight of stairs. We followed those up silently, and at the top of them, a door opened onto a balcony over a large factory floor, 2 stories high, running 300 or 400 feet down the length of the building. The remains of an overhead conveyor line were still there. It had probably once carried sides of beef from the slaughter pen to various processing stations, but the machinery that had been there was all gone. All that was left were the heavy metal frames, empty now, which had once held the machines in place, and a few rusted, lonely old transport dollies that must once have been loaded up with packaged ribs and steaks and ground beef. In the middle of the floor were a dozen brand-new work lights, blazing away, and an enormous wooden conference table complete with big leather chairs, brightly illuminated in the glow of the lamps. There was a second table loaded with what looked like a catered dinner, covered with dishes, drinks, and a fancy coffee machine. A few feet away from that was a small pen of wire mesh, and inside it were a dozen restless brown and tan goats.
Goats?
Huh. Nicodemus was sitting with one hip on the conference table, a styrofoam coffee cup in his hands, smiling genially. Asher was just being seated in a chair, which one of Nicodemus's guards held out for her solicitously. Binder sat down in the chair beside her, nodded to Nicodemus, and folded his arms with the air of a man prepared to be patient. Deirdre approached the table in her girl disguise, holding a cup of coffee in each hand, offering them to the new arrivals, smiling pleasantly. There were half a dozen of Nicodemus's tongueless guards in sight on catwalks above the floor, and Squire Jordan, now all cleaned up, was waiting for us at the far end of the balcony. He had a sidearm, but it was holstered.
"Hi, Jordan," I said. "What's with the goats?"
He gave me a level look and said nothing.
"I don't like having guns above us and all around us," Karen said. "Screw that."
"Yep," I said.
"Go tell your boss we'll come down there when the flunkies go find something else to do."
Jordan looked like he might take umbrage at the remark.
"I don't care what you think, Jordan," I said. "Go tell him what I said or I walk. Good luck explaining to him how you lost him a vital asset."
Jordan's jaw clenched, but he spun stiffly on one heel, descended an old metal stairway to the floor, and crossed to Nicodemus. He wrote something on a small notepad and passed it to his boss. Nicodemus looked up at me and smiled. Then he handed the notepad back to Jordan, nodded, and said something. Jordan pursed his lips and let out 3 piercing whistles, which got the instant attention of the guards. Then he waved a finger over his head in a circular motion, and they all descended from the catwalks to join him. They headed out toward the far end of the floor. Asher and Binder turned to regard me as this happened, the former bright-eyed and interested, the latter justifiably apprehensive. Once the guards were out of sight, I started down the stairs, with Karen walking a step behind me and slightly to one side.
"You've grown more suspicious, Mr. Dresden," Nicodemus said as I approached.
"There's no such thing as too suspicious with you, Nicky," I said.
Nicodemus didn't like the familiar nickname. Irritation flickered over his face and was gone.
"I suppose I can't blame you. We've always been adversaries in our previous encounters. We've never worked together as associates."
"That's because you're an asshole," I said. I picked the chair 2 down from Binder and sat.
I gave him a steady look and then said to Nicodemus,
"We've already got a conflict of interest going."
"Oh?"
I jerked a thumb at Binder.
"This guy. I said the next time he operated in Chicago, we were going to have a problem."
"Christ," Binder said.
He looked at Nicodemus and said, "I told you this was an issue."
"Whatever problem you have with Mr. Tinwhistle is your personal problem, Dresden," Nicodemus said. "Until such time as the job is over, I expect you to treat him as a professional peer and an ally. If you fail to do so, I will regard it as a failure to repay Mab's debt to me, and regrettably will be forced to make such an unfortunate fact public knowledge."
Translation: Mab's name would get dragged through the mud.
I knew who she would take it out on, too. I glanced back over my shoulder at Karen, who had taken up a stance behind me and to one side, her expression distant, dispassionate, her eyes focused on nothing in particular. She gave a slight shrug of her shoulders. "Okay," I said, turning back to Nicodemus. I eyed Binder. "I'm giving you a 3-day pass, Binder. But bear in mind that I'm going to hold you responsible for what you do in my town at the end of it. I'd be cautious if I were you." Binder swallowed. At that, Asher stood up. "Hi," she said, smiling brightly. "You don't know me. I'm Hannah. Back off, my partner, before you get hurt."
"I know who you are, hot stuff," I drawled, not standing. I set my staff down across the table. "And I already backed off your partner. You can tell from how there aren't any splatter marks. Play nice, Asher." Her smile vanished at my response, and her dark eyes narrowed. She drummed her nails on the tabletop exactly once, slowly, as if contemplating a decision. A smirk touched her mouth.
"So, you're the infamous Dresden." Her eyes went past me to Karen. Asher was a foot taller than she was. "And this is your bodyguard? Seriously? Aren't they supposed to be a little bigger?"
"She represents the Lollipop Guild," I replied. "She'll represent them right through the front and out the back of your skull if you don't show a little respect."
"I'd like to see her try," Asher said. "You won't see it," Karen said softly. The room got quiet and intent for a moment, though I never heard Karen move. I knew she'd be standing there, not looking directly at anyone, watching everyone. That's a scary look if you know what really dangerous people look like. Asher did. I saw the tension start at her neck and shoulders and make her clench her jaw.
"Easy, Hannah," Binder said, his tone soothing. He knew what Karen could do on a fast draw. She dispatched some of his minions for him the last time he'd been in town.
"Dresden's given a truce. We're all professionals here, right? Easy."
"Ladies and gentlemen," Nicodemus said in a patiently strained, paternal tone. He went to the head of the table, of course, and seated himself. "Can we please settle down and get to work?"
"Fine with me," I said, not looking away from Asher and Binder, until Asher finally sniffed and returned to her seat.
"Would you care to sit, Miss Murphy?" Nicodemus asked.
"I'm fine," Karen said.
"As you wish," he said easily. "Deirdre?"
Deirdre picked up an armful of folders and came around the table, passing them out to everyone seated. She rather pointedly skipped Karen, who ignored her. I opened my rather thin folder and found a cover page that read, "Day One."
"Everyone here knows the general objective," Nicodemus said, "though I'm going to be leaving specific details vague for the time being. I trust that I need not emphasize the need for secrecy to anyone here. Our target has a great many ways of gathering information, and if he gets wind of our venture from any of them, it will certainly come to an abrupt and terminal conclusion for all of us."
"Keep your mouth shut," I said, loudly enough to be a little annoying.
"Got it."
Nicodemus gave me that not smile again.
"In order to make clear to you all the potential gains to be had in this enterprise, you shall each be paid $2 million upon our successful removal of my particular goal, guaranteed."
Karen's breath stopped for a second. My stomach did an odd thing. Man, $2 million. I mean, I wasn't going to take Nicodemus's money. I wasn't doing this for the money. Neither was she. But neither of us had ever been exactly wealthy, and there were always bills to pay. I mean, stars and stones. $2 million would buy you a lot of ramen.
"In addition," Nicodemus continued, "you are welcome to whatever you can carry away from the target. There is an unfathomable amount of wealth there, more than we could take away with a locomotive, much less on foot."
"What kind of wealth?" Binder asked. "Cash, you mean?"
"For what that is worth," Nicodemus said, an edge of contempt in his voice.
But that is collected more as a curiosity than anything else, I suspect. The real trove contains gold, jewels, art, priceless artifacts of history, virtually every rare and valuable thing to have gone mysteriously missing over the past 2,000 years has wound up there. I would suggest that perhaps filling a few packs with precious gemstones might be the most profitable and least traceable course of action for each of you. But if you simply must have something more distinctive, you are welcome to take it if you can carry it, and if it does not slow down our egress. I think it easily possible for each of you to beat the cash payment by an order of magnitude. So, not 2 million each, 22 million each. That was so much money, it almost didn't have a real meaning, which was a real meaning all by itself.
And what are you after? Asher asked, openly suspicious. If you're willing to dish out 2 million to each of us, you certainly aren't hurting for money. You don't need a backpack of diamonds.
Her reasoning made me like her a little more. Her tone doubled it. Nicodemus smiled.
I'll make that clear to you before we go in. For now, suffice to say that it is a single small article of relatively little monetary value.
Liar, I thought.
As I said to Dresden before, he has known me only as an adversary. Much of my reputation has been made from those who have opposed me, those who survived the experience, that is.
He smiled and took a sip of coffee.
There is another side to that coin. One does not operate for as many years as I have by betraying allies. It simply isn't practical. Certainly, one uses every weapon one has when dealing with foes, but when I work with associates, I do not turn aside or leave them behind. It is not from any sense of sentiment. It is because I do business with many people over the course of centuries, and treachery is a bad long-term investment. It simply isn't good business.
Liar, I thought. But maybe a little less emphatically than I had before. What he was saying made sense. In the supernatural world, there were plenty of people and things that counted their lifespan in centuries. Wrong a wizard when he's young, for example, and you could wait 300 years to find out he was never able to put it behind him, and has been working to gain the clout he needs to make it clear to you that your actions were unacceptable. Cross a vampire, and it could haunt you for millennia. A certain degree of cutthroat pragmatism was what made any kind of alliance between various supernatural entities possible. I had seen it between my grandfather and a professional assassin called the Hellhound. I had seen it when squaring off against various bad guys over the years, most of whom were willing to make a deal of some kind. Hell, I'd done it with Mab, and she was doing it again with Nicodemus by sticking me here. So it was entirely possible that he was on the up and up, or at least that he was as sincere as I was about following through on the whole alliance thing. We had to get his MacGuffin and get out again. Until then, I was betting, he might be good to his word. And after that, everything would be up in the air. On the other hand, Nicodemus had gone out of his way to remove as much memory of himself as possible from the human race by destroying records of his deeds over the centuries. Guys who are on the up and up don't go to those lengths to hide what they've done. Not that it mattered. Mab had given her word. I had to play nice until we had grabbed the loot from Hades, or until Nicodemus tried to stick a knife in my back. Fun, fun, fun. I flipped to the second page of the folder and found a photo of a woman I knew and hadn't seen in, hell's bells, had it been almost 10 years? She hadn't changed much in that time, except for maybe looking leaner and harder. I wasn't sure she'd be at all happy to see me, and I knew for damn sure what she would think of Nicodemus. And since when had I become the guy that things happened to 10 years ago? Nicodemus continued in his lecture voice,
Entry to the target in the Never Never requires us to find a matching site here in the mortal world. That means breaking into a high-security facility in the real world before we can even get started in the Never Never. I raised my hand. Pursuant to that, Nicodemus said, and then paused. He sighed. Yes, Mr. Dresden. You've got to be kidding me, I said. She's never going to work with you.
Probably not, Nicodemus agreed.
She may, however, work with you. We need an expert in security systems with a working knowledge of the supernatural world. The pool of such individuals is rather small. I've arranged a meeting with her at a local event in approximately 90 minutes. You and Miss Asher will make contact and convince her to join our cause.
Suppose she won't, I asked.
Be more convincing, he said. We need her in order to proceed. I clenched my teeth and then nodded once. Hell, if he needed her to make it happen, then by screwing this up, maybe I could make sure it didn't.
Fine, but it's me and Murphy.
No, Asher said. It's me and Binder.
I'm afraid the event is a formal one, Nicodemus said. I've taken the liberty of securing appropriate attire and identities for Dresden and Miss Asher, neither of which would be compatible with Miss Murphy or Binder.
Perhaps Miss Murphy could serve as your driver. She has the shoes for it.
I couldn't actually hear Karen grind her teeth, but I knew she had.
Binder, Nicodemus said, I have another errand for you. You'll need to pick up the fifth member of the team at the train station. He stated that he'll only meet someone he knows.
Binder nodded once.
Who is it?
Goodman Gray.
Binder's face went pale.
Yes, I've worked with the gent.
Who is he? Asher asked.
He's not a man to cross, Binder said. But a pro. I'll pick him up. Smoother that way.
Asher pressed her lips together as if she didn't like it, but nodded.
Fine, then. She looked down the table at me and smiled. Well, Dresden, it looks like it's time to put on our party dress.
Gee, I said. What fun. And I closed the folder on the picture of Anna Valmont. Chapter 8. Deirdre brought me a garment bag and pointed me to a small employee's kitchen and break room with another pair of work lights set up in it. I went in, closed the door, and opened the garment bag. There was a black tux inside with all the necessary accoutrements. I held it up enough to determine that it looked like a tolerable fit. For a moment, I had a few paranoid misgivings. What if the entire point of the exercise had been to get me to take off the coat so that they could open fire with a machine gun and grease me through the wall? I already knew what it was like to be shot, and I was pretty well over the experience. Visions of Sonny Corleone danced in my head. But I didn't think that was going to happen. Karen was on guard outside. There was no way they'd move a gun into position without her at least making noise to warn me. Then, too, Nicodemus had plans in motion. I didn't think he'd want to jeopardize his faithful associate image until he could screw everyone over much more dramatically and permanently. And if he just murdered me outright, Mab would take it personally. I don't care how long you've been in business. If you cross Mab, you can skip your next 5-year plan. So I doffed the coat, stripped down, and started getting dressed in the tux. I was at pretty much the damnedest point of the process when the door opened again, and Hannah Asher prowled into the room, carrying a garment bag of her own. She gave me a slow and blatant once-over, that small smirk still on her mouth. I'm pretty sure the temperature of the room didn't literally go up, but I couldn't have sworn to it. Some women have a quality about them, something completely intangible and indefinable, which gets called a lot of different things depending on which society you're in. I always think of it as heat, fire. It doesn't have to be about sex, but it often is. And it definitely was with Hannah Asher. was extremely aware of her body and her eyes. Her expression told me that she knew exactly what effect she was having on me, and that she didn't mind having it in the least. I'd say that my libido kicked into overdrive, except that didn't seem sufficient to cover the rush of purely physical hunger that suddenly hit me. Hannah Asher was a damned attractive woman, and I'd been on that island for a long, long time. I turned my face away from her and tried to ignore her while I laid out my cummerbund. Mighty wizards do not get rattled because someone sees them standing around in their boxer briefs. "Damn, Dresden," she said, taking a few steps to one side and looking me over again. A slow smile spread over her mouth. "Do you work out?" I said, "Parkour." The answer seemed to amuse her. "Well, it's definitely working for you." She hung the garment bag up on a cabinet handle and unzipped it by feel, her eyes on me the whole time. "So many scars." She had long arms. Her fingers brushed my shoulder. "What's that one?" The touch sent a zing of sensation down my spine and through my belly. There wasn't anything magically coercive about it. I'd been on alert for that kind of nonsense from the moment my feet had hit the shore. It was worse than that. Chemistry, pure and simple. My body had the idea that Asher was exactly what I needed, and it wasn't paying any attention to my brain. I pulled my shoulder away from her, gave her a glare, and said, "Hey, do you mind?" She folded her arms, her smile widening. "Not at all. Where'd you get it?" I glowered and turned back to my tux. The FBI shot me, maybe 12 years ago. "Seriously?" Hannah asked. "It faded out really well." "It's like that with wizards," I said. "Your left hand," she said. "That's from fire." "Vampires, flunky," I said. "Homemade flamethrower." "Which court?" she asked. "Black." "Interesting," she said, and stripped out of her sweater in one smooth motion. Her body was exactly as pleasant to look at as the contours of the sweater had promised, possibly more so. My libido approved vigorously. I hurriedly turned my back. "Hey!" "You're kidding, right?" she asked, something like laughter in her voice. "Turning your back, really? On this? What kind of big-time badass are you anyway, Dresden?"
"The kind who doesn't know you, Miss Asher," I said.
"That's a fixable problem, isn't it?" she asked, her voice teasing. "And it's Miss Asher all of a sudden, huh? I wonder why that is." Her black satin bra hit the counter in my peripheral vision. It had little bits of frilly lace along the edges. I hurriedly jumped into the pants before I embarrassed myself. "Look," I said, "we're working together. Can we just get the job done, please?"
"Not nearly so many scars on your back," she noted. "You don't run for much, do you?"
"I run all the time," I said, stuffing my arms into the shirt. "But if you let yourself get attacked from behind a lot, you don't get scars. You get a hole in the ground." Her boots made some clunking sounds on the floor. Socks and jeans joined the bra on the counter.
"This thief we're picking up," she said. "You two have some history, huh?"
"Sort of," I said. "She stole my car." She let out a brief laugh.
"And you let her?"
"She gave it back," I said. "I bailed her out of trouble once."
"Think you can get her to go with us?"
"If it was just me, it would be more likely," I said.
"Or maybe you'd try to throw a wrench into the works by making sure she didn't get on board," she said, her tone wry. "After all, you like Nicodemus so much."
"Oops." The woman was sharp.
"What?"
I asked.
"Based on your response, I'm going to assume that you don't have much of a poker face either," she said. Cloth made soft, rustling sounds.
"Don't feel bad. It's one of the things I'm good at. I've got a feel for people."
"Meaning what?"
"Meaning that I can tell that right now you're wound up tighter than 20 clock springs," she said. "You're nervous and scared and angry, and you're about to explode with the need to have sex with something. I've met guys fresh out of prison who aren't bursting at the seams as hard as you."
I paused in the midst of fastening cufflinks. Seriously, I can promise you that you are impaired right now. You should blow off a little steam. Be good for you.
You're an expert, huh? I asked. My voice sounded a little rough.
On this? She asked, her voice teasing again. I'm not bad. Zip me.
I turned to find her facing away from me. She was wearing the hell out of a little black dress, accented with shining black sequins. Her legs were excellent. There wasn't much of a back to the dress, but there was a short zipper running a few inches up from the top of her hips. I was pretty sure she could have managed it alone, but I took a step over to her and did it up anyway. She smelled like late afternoon sunshine on wildflowers. Her long, curling hair touched the backs of my hands as they moved. I felt the winter in me stirring, taking notice of whatever had gotten to my sex drive, hungry for an outlet. That wasn't a good thing. Winter thought sex was almost as much fun as violence, and that they went even better mixed together, like chocolate and peanut butter. I started multiplying numbers in my head and stepped away again, focusing on getting dressed, and 8 times 8, and putting on socks without sitting down or noticing the woman whose gaze remained on me. Man, she said finally, you've been burned more than once. I fastened the pre-tied tie onto the collar and straightened it by feel.
You have no idea.
Fine, she said, her voice steady and calm. You don't want to have fun at work, that's cool. I like you, I like your style, but this job is important to me and to my partner. Get it right. You screw us over, and you and I are going to have a problem.
You really think you can take on a wizard of the White Council, Miss Asher? I asked.
I have so far, she said, without a trace of threat or bravado. I turned to face her and found her on something almost like eye level with me, thanks to a pair of heels that went with the dress. She was fastening a diamond tennis bracelet onto her left wrist. I stepped up close to her and took the ends of the bracelet in my fingers.
You should hear my terms, too, I said, and as I did, I could hear the winter in my voice, making it quiet and cold and hard. This town is my home. You hurt any mortals in my town, I take you out with the rest of the trash. And you should remember the state of my back. If you start thinking about putting a knife in it, try it, and I'll bury you.
The clasp closed, and I looked up to see her keeping a straight face, but I could see considerable uncertainty behind it. She drew her arm back from me a shade too quickly, and kept her eyes on my center of balance, as if she was expecting me to take a swing at her. I'd had to talk tough to monsters and dangerous people before. I just couldn't remember doing it while sharing a somewhat intimate domestic moment, like getting dressed together, or while helping them put on jewelry. There was something in that gesture that made Hannah Asher a person, first, a woman, and a dangerous warlock, second. And I had effectively threatened her during that moment, which had probably just made me, to her, a dangerous warden of the White Council / paranormal criminal thug first, and a human being second.
Super. Harry Dresden, intimidator of women. Probably not the best foot to get off on with someone with whom I was about to face considerable intrigue and danger. Maybe next time I just stick a gun in her face.
You look great, I said in a voice that sounded a lot gentler than it had a few seconds before. Let's get to work.
Chapter 9. The Peninsula is one of the ritzier of the ritzy hotels in Chicago, and it has a grand ballroom measurable in hectares. The serious events of Chicago's nightlife rarely start before 8. You need time for people to get home from work and get all pretty before they show up looking fabulous. So, when we arrived around 7:30, Asher and I were unfashionably early.
I'm going to be right down here on the street,
Karen said from the front seat of the black town car Nicodemus had provided. She had checked it for explosives. I'd gone over it for less physical dangers. Not sure how long it will take, I said. Cop's gonna let you loiter?
I still know a few.